Hey everyone, it's the host of All Across America, Marco Vig, jumping in for a few seconds before the show to thank you all for listening, to let you know that I want to hear from you. Tell me what you like about the show and send me your suggestions too. Follow us on Instagram at AllXAmerica or visit the website allacrossamerica.net and you can use our contact page there. If you want to support us, we're on Patreon at patreon.com/allacrossamerica. Try to respond personally to everyone who reaches out, so say hello. All right, on with the show.
Podcasting from Portland East to Portland West, Big Pine Key to Pacific Beach, and from San Juan to Guam, this is All Across America.
Well, how about we jump right into it?
Sure, let's do
it.
All
right. I wanted to start with the most basic of questions.
Okay.
Your name. So I know you as Olivia Hill. In the book, you're Laverne Schwartz.
Yes. Okay. I have to, you know, no one has caught it enough to ask me this question.
Really? It's sometimes the most basic of questions that people don't ask, right?
You would think, you know, they read the book and they're like, oh, what's up with the name?
Right.
So I was born Laverne Hill.
Okay.
And when I started writing in Alaska, one of my mentors said to me, because I was playing around with a couple of names, she said, listen, you got to choose something and stick with it, you know, if you're not going to write under your own name or whatever it was. And so did a lot of thinking about it. And my grandfather was really, really important to me, my biological grandfather, and his name was James Oliver Hill. And I love the name Oliver.
Okay.
And I said, and I never care for the name Laverne because of all of the weird little characters that, you know, Laverne and Shirley,
Laverne, and I'm like,
give me a break. And I didn't know anyone growing up that was named Laverne, and people, you know, there were guys that were named Laverne. I'm like, that's it.
I haven't met any guys named Laverne, but
I have. And so I was really fond of that. So I decided to go with a name that honored my grandfather.
Wow.
So
okay.
I got it legally changed.
Wow. Okay. When'd you do that?
The legal part of it, well, you know, I was married, and when I did get my divorce, it was an opportunity, you know, to revert your name back to your maiden name. And then it was also an opportunity for me to really change it permanently. Yeah. So I did retain the name Laverne as my middle name. Okay. I don't use it for writing purposes. You know, I didn't want to insult my mother.
Fair enough. That's a good enough reason, right?
So, you know, like, you really didn't do a good job with this naming thing, okay?
Right.
Yeah. And she said it was based on some singer back in the 50s. Yeah. And she loved this some singer named Laverne. I don't know.
Okay.
And
yeah.
So I was named for that.
Wow. All right. Yeah. I love it. So, I mean, yeah, when you change your name, I mean, my wife and I got married, it's like, you got to go through all the social security, your driver's. If you're going to do it, that's the time to get it all done all at once. So
listen, I'm about seizing the moment. And right then I'm like, oh, wait, let me do something.
There you go. I mean, was it a change? Do you feel like it was a major change for you inside when you did that as well? Or do you feel it was a long time coming? Or
I think that, you know, when I think back on it, I think that there was a kind of a release. There was a breaking away from things and having a kind of autonomy that, you know, even, you know, if you've read the book, where I was coming to anyway, I was looking and searching on some level of myself for this sense of distancy. You know, I think, you know, everything in our lives, whether that idea of what it meant to me, you know, to have this cathartic process of naming, you know, is a very important thing.
Of course,
It is in my culture, you know, a name means so much, and in many cultures. And I think, and choosing the name also was me and choosing me on some level,
right,
and who I really thought I was that didn't get to show themselves, you know, in the everyday. But since then, my family, all of my family and people have known me back then. They still call me Laverne.
Okay.
You know, and every variations of that, Vern,
right,
you know,
right.
All of that stuff. And I'm good. And I've embraced it much more now. I think I'm a little bit more fond and kinder to the name. But I think Olivia fits me overall more.
Was it easier writing a memoir being Olivia Hill writing about Laverne Schwartz? Were you able to like kind of have that artistic separation in a way, and you know, the distancing yourself?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like when you ask, when you talk to people that speak their first language is a different language from English.
Right.
And you talk to them, they say, you know, yeah, but I still dream in Spanish, or, that sort of thing. So it's like, I still dream and think and write in Laverne.
Okay. Right. Okay.
You know, unless I'm specifically doing something that is new and it's about me, you know, as Olivia, I think pretty much the images and everything that comes to me and relationship is from that space. And yeah, I think that's it.
I mean, and it sounds to me, I mean, you know, I guess my next question is, why'd you decide to write that book? And I think a lot of it's coming back to, you know, you being Laverne. So tell me about that if you could.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, life is an interesting journey for all of us. We have our past, our present, and then our future. And every stage of our lives is represented in who we are, even if people don't know that outside. We are representing our 8-year-old selves, depending on what triggers that moment. And it can be pleasant things. It can be food. It can be a smell that comes in on the wind. Right. It can just be how the sun feels, and you're right back.
Yep.
You know, pulling from those things. And I think that we talk about those things in a very psychological, therapeutic kind of way, your little self and all that. But there is truth to that in just the ordinary, if we allow ourselves to think about it. And so when I decided to write this book, I really wrote the book at first, I thought, was for my daughter. You know, I had left Beacon, New York, had gone through a really bad marriage. Okay. And I was rediscovering myself. At that time, I actually had owned a business for about 13 years, cooking and having a gourmet food business. So I started out to be a chef.
Right.
For a while, you know, actually, you know, when I was younger, I was writing and whatever, and too long of a story, but I was writing then and then stopped writing for various traumas and reasons for growing up, you know, in a bad school district. So when I got to Alaska, my first passion, well, maybe first, more second, was food. And when I started the gourmet food business, I did that because my second born child was born on the autism spectrum.
Okay. Yeah.
And, you know, at the time that I really discovered writing, was it was as a short story writer for a brief period of time. And then I found playwriting.
Okay.
And I was a playwright, I feel like forever. I found my voice, my ear, everything fit who I was. With struggling with a lot of sort of learning disabilities, you know, having this issue of how I thought and processed and all of those kind of things. And so when I had my son, it really meant I needed to be there with him completely. And starting the business in my home, we had a commercial kitchen built in the basement.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
it was serious business
when you got a commercial kitchen.
I got to tell you, it didn't start off that way. I started out with money literally out of our food budget, you know, just out of our pocket, little by little by little, and had no intention, had intended to go back to school and get my master's degree in playwriting and leave the state that I was in and my husband for a little while. And he really wanted a child. We didn't have a child together. My first marriage, I had a child with him. And so I ended up starting this business kind of side things, just doing some preserves, chutneys. It just grew and morphed into this monster. But he could be with me all the time. He was with me. I mean, every move I made, he came to every gig and played up under the table or hung out with this community of farmers and vendors. So it was pretty cool. And it was really wonderful. But I ended up going back to writing, you know. But at the time, I couldn't do a lot of traveling, putting up plays and doing productions and having him there. That wasn't going to work. So,
All right. And you mentioned you have some grandchildren now.
I have one. I have Well, I really have two. Okay. So I have one biological grandson that just turned 13.
Oh, wow.
And the kid is like, you know, at 12, he was wearing a size 12 shoe. And I'm like, this is ridiculous, boy. And we have a generational home. So we all live together.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we have always. And it's interesting. And it's an interesting reality, but I think we all love it. You know, it has its challenges, but it's a good thing. It's a good thing.
You get a little wisdom on one end, a little IT support on the other side.
Let me tell you, my son walked over and helped me. I'm like, I don't know why this thing isn't coming on.
I saw, as I logged on, I saw the shadow of somebody.
That was him. I'm like going, help, I'm over here. I can't get it to work.
I tell you what, I'm an analog man in the digital world, and I'm still always trying to figure it out myself. And, you know, life is so difficult. Keep things simple, you know? And I mean, it's amazing to me to hear your story of living in the Alaska bush in like a place where there's no stores. I mean, like, how is that like? I mean, I go to the hardware store, I go to the dry cleaner, the post office, the library, like four, you know, I mean,
10 times a day, practically.
Yeah, I mean, did life feel more simpler then? And I mean, obviously for a lot of different reasons, but is it, you know, I mean, grass is always greener, I guess. And
it was wonderful. I mean, I'll start off by saying that word, and I did not know what all the fears that I had that was sort of built into me. I don't think, you know, if we could actually know who we would be without the influences, negative or positive, like if we could be grown in a petri dish, right? And given somehow all the stimuli we needed to be whole and healthy people, I wonder what direction we would go in. And so I think by nature, I clung to something I didn't know would be a part of kind of saving my life. And even in the inner city of Kansas City, you know, I feel blessed in spite of the fact that we didn't have a lot. You know, on paper, we were definitely considered poor, you know, in that sense. My grandmother was raising four grandchildren and in a home that, I guess, you know, my grandmother and grandfather had divorced long before I knew it and came along. But in this home that he sort of gave her in order to do this. But there were, you know, there's backyards and there's neighbors that, you know, didn't keep it up. And you have all this bramble stuff and you're like finding things and climbing things. And, you know, and like, ooh, this is the wilderness. It's the wild. And I think it was a clue then for me without really even knowing. So when I, you know, when I was going to Alaska, my bags were already packed with a lot of things.
Yeah.
Right. Like all of us are. We get every generation and what they've passed on to the one that is connected to you, all of their baggage, all of their good things, everything. And you're born into this world and there's this trunk with stuff in it already that you have to carry.
Yeah.
And then you start to navigate what you're carrying, unbeknownst to yourself, that you're wading through and making choices and doing things, not seeing these things kind of attached to you.
Right.
Right. And so, but then you're figuring out the world and he's like, well, this doesn't work with this, or you overdo something that's too much and the world is pushing back against you and like, well, what tool do I need? Right. So you start to gather things. And as you stumble along and make terrible mistakes, maybe horrible mistakes, right? You're learning to try to either shed those things or you carry those things for the rest of your life. Yeah. And so getting to Alaska, I brought a lot of fear, that I was taught to be afraid of. Okay. You know, we lived in Kansas City, which has, and I think a lot of cities did, the sort of corridor where Black people lived. And okay. you didn't get to move or go past
right.
that place. And so in coming back, when I was coming back on a regular, but particularly in the past 6 years, there were areas I had never even been in. Oh, I mean, wow. I literally had to learn what Kansas City was because I didn't have that experience up until 22 whatsoever. We were right. isolated in these communities. Right. And so that was quite the experience. And then you realize when you get there, you know, to some other place, you're right. pulling on everything you got and you're terrified. You know, they made me afraid. You know, the people I worked with before I moved, I remember, you know, I was the only African American. And then we had this elder couple that were the cooks
okay.
in the back. Right. And they were all white Americans that I work with. And I remember they telling me, you know, oh my God, you know, there's no Black people there. And you know, that I would be afraid. I'm not sure if you should go, you know, your husband's Jewish, you're Black, you know, you might get killed, you know, a lot of things. I was scared to, I'm 22. I'm terrified,
yeah.
you know, so there you go.
Wow. You know, I'm looking behind you and I see, it looks like a boot in the
yes.
frame behind you with this, the word courage and,
yes.
and you know, I mean, that wasn't put there by accident, I guess.
Yeah, actually it kind of was. You know, it's been there for quite a long time. And yeah. It was from, I don't know if you know Bread and Puppet. It's a theater troupe,
and they used yeah. to Vermont, I believe they had a annual yeah. festival. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And they traveled around, and I saw them in New York, and I just loved it. And so I bought this poster and some other posters, and this was, you know, several years ago. And I said, oh, let's stick this up. And I forgot it's even back there, but that's what it takes, you know. Yeah. I'm a boot that needs some courage. So, at least I was then.
Yeah. So, I mean, you did write, chosen to see hope in our shared history of Southern suffering from our otherness. Can you talk a little bit about that? And I think you were referring to some of the Native folks that you met and worked with in Alaska.
Yeah, I think that, I know that my experience with people, first of all, I'll say this. One of the biggest surprises that I got through this isolation, and the only outward understanding of the word came from television, or you happen to go to a doctor or a hospital and it's predominantly white, or those kind of things. And so you're trying to understand the world. And I had enough naivete to believe that, you know, if you say, for instance, were gay and lesbian, or if you were indigenous, or if you were an immigrant, that you couldn't be prejudiced.
Right.
You were like, we just had this unspoken understanding. Not true. No, it is not true. So that was the first revelation that I had, that people are influenced all over the world about who others are.
Right.
And that indoctrination that we do within families, within cultures, within cities or regions or whatever it is the thing that allows us or that informs us of how you're going to react and assume who could be trusted and who not. And a lot of these things are based on what you need. Yeah. And if what you need, a particular area, group, political standing, what all the different layers that we have in any society, then you emulate that. You dislike and disagree with whatever doesn't put you in line or closer to those things, yeah. Right? Yeah. And so you can take that idea or concept, and then you layer that with all the other things that happen within a society, a town, a state, a nation, whatever. And there you go. So in coming to know them, there was a naiveness in me.
Okay.
About how it operated, how it worked, also my prejudices around the idea that I assumed they were going to think and be like me, have the same code of honor, okay. You know, same whatever it was. And it wasn't. It wasn't that. So there was an awakening to that. But I do think that the courage comes in. The idea of courage comes in is when we allow ourselves to be enough of childlike and open enough to just listen and watch and try to understand. Because in understanding others and their differences, not as a rejection or an automatic, but how did what's the possibilities of why they are doing what they're doing and who they are and what is happening? And then you understand yourself.
Yeah.
How you get there. You know, when I was doing food and I did a lot of teaching, I did a lot of teaching culinary arts to after school kids, underprivileged kids, but I also taught culinary arts to adults that could afford to pay for it and wanted to do this. Yeah, and yeah. One of the things I used to say to them that I think is befitting in what we're talking about right now is, you know, I always came up on kids and adults saying, no, no, we don't eat that. Or really? I don't like that. Or, you know, we don't mess with, you know, shellfish, you know, stuff that crawls around on the ground, whatever. And it hit me one day that I started to tell them, I said, you know, the only reason you don't eat that, because if I asked you, have you ever had it? Pretty much 99% of the time, they would say, no, I've never tasted it before, but we don't eat that.
Okay.
It's because you were not taught mm-hmm. that is okay.
Right.
Somewhere along the line, you have parents or whoever was taking care of you that says, I'm cooking you good food. We, you know, eat lots of good pasta and you've got a wonderful gravy, this red sauce and right. cheese and things that come off the vine and, you know, and a little bit of vino and everything is just beautiful. Right. And then someone comes up and say, well, you know, let's do some pig's feet and chitlins and whatever.
Right.
But we don't eat that over there. Mm-hmm. It's because you're taught.
Yeah.
That this is the food of your people, of your home, sure. and this is good food. I'm feeding you good things. But right. every family and culture says that.
Yeah.
Where there's absolutely nothing wrong with any food that human beings eat across the world because it sustains our lives as human beings. And we've learned.
Yeah.
Over our existence as human, what humans can ingest and what they cannot. And we should be open enough to trust our cousins and however we want to see each other as a human existence,
yeah.
that we have something to offer one another in our knowledge of survival yeah. and being here now.
I mean, I certainly hear it coming from you in terms of food is kind of that guiding star for you in terms of understanding people other cultures. Yeah. I mean, it's the most important one. I mean, we all breathe the same way. We don't often eat, the same things though. So, and
you got it.
So what do you like to cook these days? I mean, now that you're not doing it as a business anymore, that's what I'm understanding. I mean, what do you like to cook on your own and for you, for folks? Like, what are your favorite dishes to make? And
well, let's talk about for me, because I still cook for the family and, and they have all eclectic taste, and things that they want, and the things that they like, don't like or whatever. If it's me, I love that sort of food that stays close to your soul. I really love soups. I have an affinity to just the simplicity of food. I love, fresh herbs and I grow things and, and I love things to be as simple and natural to what they are and what they do and to taste each thing and a good piece of bread that you've baked and, good olive oil and, oh my God, my mouth is watering. So, I do love it. And every now and then, I just get this bug. I'm really inspired by being able to go to a market, which Kansas City suffers with that. I love diversity. So I want to go into an open air market and I want to pick up some produce that I've never seen before.
Yeah.
I want to smell it. I want to be surrounded by it. I want to know what's that.
Yep.
And if it can be tasted even before it's cooked, then I want to taste it and I want it on my palate and I'll know what to do with it. Yeah. I've always had that gift. If I can smell it and taste a little bit over it, I'm good. I'll know what to do with it. So I love that. And what I'm finding is hard to get inspired with these limitations. It's the same thing. You go into a mainstream grocery store and it's the same. You got your cabbage, you got your bread. It's the same. Oh my God. It drives me absolutely nuts. So I'm not very inspired, but what I will get inspired by, because it's limited here, we're not on a coast. So you don't even get those interesting, seafood that's coming in that you just want to say, I want to be challenged. Let me just play with this, please. But I can go out in the woods and I can gather greens that most people don't eat. And I'll play in that way. So I'll gather things and work with it. Yeah.
Like foraging.
I do.
How'd you learn that skill? Something that's generally passed down. I mean, maybe it was, I don't know.
Well, it was in part because my grandmother and grandfather were farmers. They came off the farm in Arkansas.
Okay.
And they were the first to come to Kansas City. My grandfather came first and then sent for my grandmother and my father. They only had one child. And they sort of populated here. From there, they helped siblings, came from a huge farm family, took them off the farm. And eventually my great grandparents that I knew up until I was 13 years old. So with all that said, they always had big gardens, especially my great grandparents. It was like, walking into an English garden, as far as I concerned. That was my English garden.
That's cool.
We would walk down this path and it's lined with flowers I had never seen before. You get to the side of the house and it's covered with butterflies and moths and hummingbirds and bees and every kind of thing you can think of. And I'd never seen anything. You get in the backyard and they had fruit trees back there and every side of it was loaded with food. And I'm like, whoa, But my grandmother, because of the issue of raising four grandchildren and as a domestic is what she did. She worked for very wealthy people here in Kansas City. And she was also a cook, And so she would get a gig with, someone that was a caterer cooking for the synagogues for Jewish people.
Okay.
And the joke always ended up being that that's why I ended up marrying a Jewish man, because because I had grown up eating this food. So anyway, when in times of really lean times, very lean times, my grandmother had remarried my sub-grandfather that I'm not fond of at all, caused a lot of abuse and harm. But they would go hunting. They would go and get rabbit and squirrel and go fishing and doing all those things. And my grandmother would get wild plants that we call weeds, but she knew the value of them as food. And she would gather those things, pokeweed, and teach me just casually and say, you can't, don't eat this. You never touch this. You don't eat the berries. They're poisonous. And you can only pick these leaves at this time. And this is what you do with them. And so we ate gathered food when things were really, really lean and rough. I mean, I remember times of no food, you know, and then commodities came in, but she made everything from scratch, everything by hand. And she was one of the most brilliant women I've ever known in my life. She was clever and smart beyond her years. She made salves and things to heal her body. She gave us things that it took until, books came out much later that all of a sudden I'm reading things. I'm like, wow, my grandmother always did this. And and I had always heard for a long time that, you know, oh, this is not important, whatever. And it was. And then they discovered, oh, no, we did. She was brilliant. She really was.
And you seem to have, at least my sense from the book was that you had some conflicted emotions about your grandmother. Could you tell us about that? And
I did. I had very conflicted emotions about her. I was made to be incredibly dependent on her and fearful of all of the world, and abused by her harshness and brutality, and what appeared to be cruelty to me. She isolated us, and, you know, a lot of really terrible, terrible things happened to myself and my siblings. And on the other hand, as I said, she was brilliant. And, you know, I think the way to describe her is that I'm not sure if I can't remember if I put it in the final cut of this book, but her hands could pick up food and plant it in your mouth, and you could taste not only the food, but there was something special about the very taste of her fingers and her hands that was so nurturing. Or she could stroke your head and your back in times of sickness and illness. And then there was the darker other side, that those hands could bruise and cut and beat and hate and hurt. And trying to reconcile and understand that. As a child, I both loved and hated her. Deeply. Is the glass of those two things were equally full.
Which is rare, which is hard to conceptualize. You know, it's like this cognitive dissonance in some ways, and you know, you're pulling you in both directions. Let me ask you this: I mean, you grew up in a multi generation household. You live in one now, and now you're the grandmother. So, I mean, do you often you catch yourself at times? You know, how I mean, because I'm a parent now, and I'm like, as I catch myself like my parents, and I'm like, this could be a good thing, or that could be a really bad thing.
I think that, you know, you will always carry every part of yourself with you. No matter how hard you try to erase away the things that you carry of others that are now part of your DNA of being. you have to reconcile with yourself that it is there.
Yeah.
It is permanent. And your job is not to live a life lying to yourself that you can make it go away and be something pre these events.
Yeah.
What you can do is lessen it. What you can do is shape and allow that river of stuff to flow slightly differently, to let the landscape of how the river of these events can take a different shape, yeah, sort of swing out a little bit more and get down the road. And I think what I learned early on in raising my children, particularly my daughter, she saw a wider range of me fighting to overcome these things. And she had to take into herself much more of it than the rest of them did. However, I think what it taught me, the one thing I held on to that I did do, is that I promised each one of them I would always listen and I would always earnestly own what I've done, what I've said, and what I didn't get right. I will own that. Okay. I will be there through anything you're going through to heal or understand. I will be there.
Okay.
Because I didn't get that. Right. I, you know, there was never an apology. And I, what I come to realize is that in order for my grandmother to have done that, she would have had to live with the agonizing pain, because she was already in pain. Anyone that abuses or hurts, they are living through something. You can't kick a dog and not feel anything at all. You do it enough, you like, God, I didn't mean to do that. And even if you get mad and kick them again and you want to blame them, you are living in some terrible muck. Right. And so for her to acknowledge out loud would have meant for her to face everything she didn't get right.
I mean, I love the river analogy in that, you know, sometimes people become reactionaries. And, you know, if you follow the river analogy, you grow, you're learning and you're growing and it's, you know, charting your course, not in 180 degrees, but, you know, just a couple degrees. But, you know, some people, they can't flow with it and they become a reactionary and, you know. And
I agree.
And I'm always trying to avoid that in my own self. So with, but the river analogy is something that's going to have to stick with me. So. Yeah. Well, maybe you could tell us about Seth.
What can I say about Seth?
How he became, you know, how he influenced you. And, you know, I mean, obviously he was a main character in the book. So, and you know, I want to hear about him and I want to hear about him and how it changed you and that river.
Yeah, he changed me a great deal. It's funny how relationships changes any of us. You live with them long enough, and before you know it, you have phrases or behaviors that you don't even think about. Right. And then you get down the road and someone says, you know, your wife or your husband always says that. And you're like, no, he doesn't, you know, or you sound just like him or whatever it is. And so he did. And one of the ways in the beginning that he changed me most is that he made me realize my worth.
Yeah.
And yet, kind of like my grandmother.
Yeah.
He also stepped on that worth. You know, I think that we are destined to a degree of repeating, you know, those things that we draw to us, the people that we kind of have rejected in many ways, because I think we're still trying to figure out. We're trying to understand that past thing that created and made us. And it's not conscious. You just constantly keep getting those people and trying to correct it or fix it or understand it or be better from it or something.
Yeah.
And so as I looked at him in retrospect, you know, he was very much those things to me. And he was he was wonderful in many ways. I used to say early on, I think I would refine it a little bit now, but one of the things I used to say is that he saved my life.
Wow.
And, you know, the book, I don't know. I would hope that the book and the piece of the book that I've written does bear that out.
Yeah.
You know, because I found something in myself, even in that piece of it. And the bigger piece of it, he saved my life in many ways. Right. He saw value in me. He thought, saw me as being very bright and intelligent. Yeah. And yet he had his own confliction and resentments and the baggage in the, you know, the trunks that he was carrying
right, as well.
For whatever reason, he needed me in his life or what I represented. He was playing out his own stuff, right?
Yeah. I mean, do you feel like at times, you had mentioned this Peace Corps, volunteering. I mean, did he have like a white savior complex? I don't know if it would have been called that at the time, but...
Well, you know, and I think I mentioned, I don't know how far you got in the book, but I think I mentioned.
I finished it.
Oh, good. So I think I mentioned at one point that, you know, I wondered whether I was just a project.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, again, in examining myself, I can give him grace now because we're all a project to ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah,
even when you don't know it,
be a project,
right?
Certainly seems to be a project.
Yeah, and I married this man for things I didn't even know at the time. It was not conscious that I was doing it. I married him because he was kind to me.
Yeah,
I married him because he seemed to admire and respect and give me a level of a presence, like he allowed me to feel I was real and I was here and I had value just by, wow, you know, he wants me and he thinks I'm smart and he thinks I'm all of these things. And again, it got a little sticky along the line there where that may or may not been true, but I was never seen. I was never valued. I had very little worth here, not only within my family, but within society that gave me no place here whatsoever, didn't value me in school, you know, got no help with all of the learning issue, didn't expect me to be anything. No one expected me to be anything.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you had said that you had both come from dysfunctional families and that drew you together in some ways. Can you talk a little bit about his family and, you know, how that shaped him? And
Well, I think, first of all, we have to even think about historically, you know, the trauma that Jewish people carry in their ancestry history throughout their existence.
Sure.
There's a great deal of similarity.
Okay.
You know, with colonization and the African being brought here and the continent itself being raped of all of its resources and enslaved overall by different conquerors. So you look at the history of, you know, the Jews talk a lot about, you know, their persecution throughout history.
Okay.
Through their sense of existence. Right. And I look at the persecution of dark melanin skinned people, diasporas that are all over the world that are brutalized in one way or another, or dismissed or not valued because of the color of their skin. So you just start there. And then you talk about all that stuff that is heaped upon a culture to navigate. Now, their navigation allowed them, for various reasons, they could pass.
Okay.
If they chose to.
Right.
They were able to build things to keep their culture intact in many ways and become successful in spite of still having to endure oppression.
Yeah.
Black people didn't have that opportunity.
Yeah.
You can never hide really what and where your ancestry comes from.
Sure.
And so without having generational wealth,
right,
it doesn't allow you certain opportunities okay. that could keep and build you. And so we have much more the masses of Black Americans, the Africans that came here right. and that are all over that are suffered and struggled and do all that. And now you talk about the family itself.
Yeah.
You know, he came from a family that had money.
Yeah.
Part of the family did not okay. have money, but married into the money of that family.
Okay.
And all of the baggage and the pain of that mixture of those things informed who he was.
Yeah.
And then him enduring his own rejection and abuse by being Jewish, living in community that didn't accept his Jewishness and okay. bullied him. And, you right. know, so he had his own things to carry that allowed him to, I think, play out maybe what he was trying to fix, but he was trying to fix outside of himself.
Okay. All right.
Right. Just like we all do. You know, yeah. I have my own savior complex. I have brought so many people into my children's lives, wow. Homeless people that have lived with us. My son just asked me the other day how many people that live with us. And we got up to about six, I think it was six or seven people that oh. I have brought in.
You wow. know? Okay. Wow.
You know, so
yeah, it's interesting because I saw, you know, you had written about New Testament. Love is the greatest commandment of them all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I grew up, I always laugh and I always say to people, I grew up with this crippling sense of humility. And okay. I literally mean that. Yeah. My grandmother believed you do not draw attention to yourself, that you don't be too proud and self-important,
okay.
That it's about sort of service, what you do for others. Don't get your britches too big, you know, and
you're destined to become an artist and a playwright.
I was listen.
So fun. You know, it's such polar opposites of yeah, it's about
yeah, 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 wow. yeah, for sure. And so in that sort of sense, you know, that's what I became. I don't know, I literally don't think I ever will. I don't know how to think of me first.
Okay.
If I go to, if I say, hey, kids, I need to go pick up myself some underwear. I don't know. Right. And I head out to the store, I will see things and shop for my kids or someone else. I'm like, oh, that would be, they really need that. I know they right. need that. Yeah. And yeah. I will end up coming back with all of this stuff and there's no underwear.
right.
Yeah.
Right, right. I mean,
that's just it. And I was like, oh well, you know.
So how long were you and Seth together for? I mean, the book itself kind of this right here, yeah. I guess about a year in your lives.
That was a year. More. Yeah, it was a year in our life. And just to tell you, the second book is coming.
That was my next question. I said, there's got to be a sequel here.
The second, and you know, I'm pondering this because, you know, the journey can be long. There's all these things, but the second book is coming. And what I want to try to address with the second book for my audience, for people at large, that is really, you know, I care about sort of telling that truth and sharing those things that we ordinarily wouldn't share. You know, we like to kind of package ourselves and tell a nice story, but in a nice way. And that's not my yeah. job.
Right.
My job is, is to really give humanity the opportunity and the path of how we have a responsibility to really bear it all so that those that come after us can make different choices. They don't have to keep carrying around that trunk that of stuff that was given to them. And shame.
It really is. And it's getting back to the earlier theme.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want that. I want them to say, okay, now I get it. I get what was all in you. So what I'm passing to the kids, they can make choices, you know, about those things. And so that's what I'm hoping. So the next book is coming, and the next book is really much more about when you go through the healing process, it's worse than what others did to you. It is now what you do with that stuff and what you do to yourself. And you think you're on easy street, but it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
You know, and the truth of the matter is you can do therapy for your whole life, but don't ever let anyone tell you, and don't you allow yourself to believe that you will be fixed.
Okay. Yeah.
What you are is a broken vase. Or vessel. Yeah. And you glue that vessel together, and it may, you know, it can hold water again, but you see all the cracks that are not as strong. It is still fragile.
Yeah.
It is together.
Yeah.
But you bear and you carry those scars, and you try to set on the mantelpiece as beautifully as you can, as strong as you can, and say, I still have worth.
So
I see that bearing for that reason.
Okay.
And that, yes, my job, you know, my daughter always says to me, and even my son, is that I value you because you never stop trying to be better. Wow. You're always turning over. How else can I look at this?
Yeah.
But even when I do it terribly bad that day, and I'm driving along and I'm yelling at some driver that cut me off or whatever, you know, I analyze, I go in and I really check in and say, what is that about? And how could I have done that differently? And what am I really carrying? And I think that's what's important. So we did stay together. We stayed together for almost 10 years.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And you were in Alaska during the time. I think you had mentioned you were a University of Alaska Fairbanks graduate.
I did. I ended up, he left Alaska, and I ended up living there 13 years.
Oh, wow. So you stayed after he left.
I did.
Wow.
I did. And I would still be there. It was the hardest thing for me to ever do. It was very difficult for me to leave there. But through some of the things that I'll talk about in the next book, I felt like the very land itself that had sort of nurtured me back to a sense of humanity.
Okay.
I often said to people, I feel Alaska helped me find a sense of humanity that I never had. And it's an extraordinarily beautiful place. It's one of the most beautiful places you'll ever find on this earth.
Yeah.
And yet it is unforgiving. It is harsh.
Yeah.
It can cost you your life.
Okay.
And with that, it focuses your attention.
Yeah.
It helps you to truly be humane to yourself. You have to be laser focused on what it means to not only survive here, but for everything to survive and anyone to survive. And you have to drop away, lose the frills and the superficial of life, because you're maintaining and you're understanding. Now, a lot of Alaska is obviously changing very fast. There's bigger cities. I eventually lived in Fairbanks, Alaska, and they're bringing all the trappings and the things that you have in any kind of city. But I got the opportunity to be a little more closer to nature, to live very, very simply, you know. We had a house built from the ground up, and I ended up living most of my time in a cabin with an outhouse.
Wow.
Okay. With my daughter.
Wow.
So there you go.
Wow. Yeah. And you had mentioned, you know, one of the themes that I always loved about Alaska, and you had said Alaska is the kind of place that people run to be something different from the rest of the lower 48, to have the freedom to choose their way. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Well, if you know anything about Alaska, especially when I came in the early 80s, they had these really hardcore sourdoughs. You know, they don't believe in a lot of federal government. You know, we do it our way. You know, let us figure it out.
Kind
of
mentality. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. To the core. And I really just think that rather, I agree with some of all of those things. Yeah. I do believe that human beings need to be in an environment so that they can test themselves.
Yeah.
Not prove themselves to others.
Yeah.
There's a difference when you're in a corporation and you're always trying to climb the ladder and you're always trying to prove I can do it. And that will you give me this bigger salary or this bigger position?
Sure.
You are testing yourself with self.
Yeah.
You are grounding yourself in what we really are and meant to be a part of the whole of our environment, and that is nature. Yeah. And everything we have done is to pull ourselves away from that and to create a reality in the world where we're in control and we just keep building and wanting and getting, right, of things that cannot last. But what can last is that building of the sense of humanness and self and be challenged and to pass that on for the sake of the future of humanity is important, because in reality, we do live forever.
Yeah.
My belief now is, and I feel very strongly about it, is that we are part of everything.
Okay.
We will, you know, there's only one source of water and we keep recycling it in our.
Yeah.
Right. It never leaves. It never gets replenished.
It's not coming. It creates the clouds and it rains.
And it just keeps doing this. So every time every human being on this earth or animal or insect or whatever it is drinks something or eats something, they're eating and drinking a part of ourselves. I was just listening to a program. I don't remember A1, some program I was listening to. And on public radio, and they were talking about finding the DNA of humans everywhere, on plants, on we're existing. We are there.
Yeah.
This is us.
Yeah.
All of us. And we're doing these petty, ridiculous things, and we never leave here. We're always a part of it. And why not make the energy of the part where we're in this state of our being, of talking and living and dressing and eating and making decisions, something that what we leave in our beings better for our own existence, as well as all the rest that will always be here.
Yeah. You had talked about, you know, giving yourself to help others, and you had talked very candidly about sex. Can you talk about why you wanted to put that and really to put yourself out there in that way?
You know, someone else asked me that in a little different way, and about how I could bear my soul so unabashedly, and yet it didn't feel kind of voyeurist, you know,
right.
It felt like, you know, that they felt and others felt that they could relate without shame, that sort of be there in that moment. And I think that, I do, and I did, because we just had this great conversation when we started about food.
Yeah,
we had this great conversation about taste and your palate and the passion of eating certain things and doing all that. And that's very easy. Well, it's just as true about how we are intimate with ourselves. Yeah. Everything from holding hands or caressing a baby or having intercourse or intimate relationship with someone that allows you to do all these other things too. That's so much a part of us. And a lot of that is getting and is broken. Yeah. It's broken in how we see ourselves, how we use our bodies in all ways, whether, you know, it's overeating and food or the poisons we're putting in it or the plants that we're destroying and the animals that are diseased. We are also diseasing our intimacy. And I think that my choice to talk about the conflicts of that came from the fact that I am a survivor. I am a survivor and of child sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, and all that plays a part of my sexuality, my choices, and to pretend that that's not there about why I question something or what I need or how I choose to respond and to react with things is all a part of everything that I've had to drag around.
Right.
I didn't make the choice about. And I'm trying to figure it out, just like all the rest of us are. And we're so shameful. We're so like, oh, you know, I won't ask my partner to do this, or I can't talk about this, or I can't say that this really makes me uncomfortable because it'd make me look less of a man, or it'd make me seem less sexy, you know, as a woman or whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
But we have to. We must. Yeah.
You talked, you mentioned conflict, and I think one of the main conflicts in the book was with Mehdi. Can you talk a little bit more about him and why you decided to include that? And
that, you know, that's funny because that was the I can't believe I'm saying this, but to be honest, that was probably the motivation for me writing this book, I thought, in the beginning.
Wow.
That man vexed me. and he did it because if you think about the story itself and everything we're talking about now, he embodied all of, for me in that moment anyway, all of the things that I felt was wrong. When I was a young teen, probably, you know, 13, 14 years old or something. Okay. I remember hearing something on the news or whatever it was. I'm not even sure what it was. And I remember being so angry and going into my room and punching the bed and just crying up under my pillow and so angry because I felt like there were these bullies in the world that had the ability to hurt people.
Wow.
And nobody was standing up and saying, no, you can't do this, and stopping them. And I remember crying out to God. I just couldn't understand. You have all this power. You can't just go like poof and stop them. And it taught me early on that there's a play that I wrote. I won a Lorraine Hansberry for. It's called Mother Spence. And there was a line in there where the sort of the victim character of it that had gone through things and changed. And she calls out and speaks to the grandma and she says, God's not listening. He's just watching and waiting. And so if there is truth in that, then it's our responsibility to stand up for those people that are willing, rather it's through their own stuff, but they must be stopped and made to see and not to do this to anyone that is hurt through your brutality and meanness is innocent, whether they're 50 or 5.
Yeah.
And so we have a responsibility. And so he sort of encompasses that part of my understanding from the beginning of the world and what they have the power to do to you, and you don't have any arms to fight back.
Yeah. But you did.
But I did. And I don't know that I did it in the most effective way, but well, at the time, that's what I knew to do.
Seemed to work. I mean, you said you felt taller, you felt bigger, you know, you stood up for you. I mean, I've had that same feeling, particularly recently as well. And
oh, good.
Feels good. It feels good.
It does because you know, it can build on itself. We won't always win, right?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you don't, but that's not why you stop fighting. And it's not even why you do fight. It's about the integrity of planting the seed that we must.
Yeah.
We must be as intentional and a part of that process. There's the smallest thing is not too small.
Yeah.
We must be a part of it, not only for the sake of who we call as a victim, but for the sake of the bully that was a victim, likely at some point.
Right. Yeah.
It's about changing all of that.
Yeah.
So that it's different. And yes, it can be overwhelming when you realize you spend your life doing this and it hasn't changed. But without it, whatever you championed, that person doesn't get the opportunity to have hope,
right,
that it could change. And that's worth everything. That's worth everything to make a human being's life just that much more better so that they're living and dying. Think about the people in the world that are born into the world, born into poverty and cruelty and dictatorship, that lives and they die, and they have not had the opportunity to feel pleasure and kindness and freedom. They deserve that.
Yeah.
Their spirits deserve that.
They do.
And if that's what we can do, then, you know, do that.
You talked about, I want to bring it back to Kansas City, and you talked about 31st and Gillum Road, and you called it the crossroads of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there are these places and time and space where something happened, and it changed the projection of where you would go and what happened to you.
Okay.
Yeah. That place changed the moment that I had my mother as a little infant kid, and when I would not and be raised by a, you know, paternal grandmother.
Right, right.
Those were the crossroads, and we all have those crossroads.
Right.
We all have that incident where we're not even there, not even thought of. And that's the difference between whether you are here or there, whether you're named this or that, or rather whatever it is.
Yeah.
And you have to, you know, it is important, I think, to come to a reckoning with those places in those times. Understand them. Because we're making them for our own children.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We are. And the more you understand, I think, about your own journey, your own path, and those things, again, that has been given to you in those trunks that you don't have any say-so about what you get them. You got them.
You got them. That's it.
And even if you deny them, right? Even if you walk away from your family, I did that 3,000 miles.
Yeah.
Cut them off. They're with you.
Yeah.
It's not going anywhere. So you better order that stuff and get to understanding it so you can have some influence on making choices and decisions.
You told me, or in the book, you had, and I just listened to it before we jumped in the call, Shadows and Light was your wedding song, Joni Mitchell's song. Can you talk about that? And, you know, one of the first lines is, every picture has its shadows and some source of light.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that was the other thing that Seth gave me was this broad. I was always an oddball. I think that some of us are born at times in our lives where this is my own belief. Anyway, you know, I've thought about this over the years. And so sometimes we're born at a time where nothing. There's a lot of things that happen to either the generation before you or just before your birth And there's a lot of things that ends up happening after. And you're kind of at that crossroads, right? Mm-hmm. You are the person born into the world at that time.
Yeah.
When you're standing there, you know, you're standing there and you can't make change and things are just happening all around you. And I really think that when I was born, you know, we were at that point. So, yeah. Right. So I was born in 60 and then came up in part of the 60s and mainly the 70s when, you know, you're in your teens. So and what was happening in the country at that point. Yeah. And I talk about this because I think that if you look at why you were born at that time and what's happening in the world, there's a great impact on you.
Right.
There's even one that you don't even know unless you really investigate and you go, oh, there was a lot of violence and death, you know, during the time of the civil rights movement. I grew up during those times.
Yeah.
I grew up during a time in an inner city with Black people that had drugs brought into their community.
Okay.
There was a lot of trying to survive and trying to have something. There was violence and prostitution and drugs and that came out because of the drugs. Right. And all of that, there was this incredible intensity of this stuff that I came about. And yet, here's the civil rights movement fighting through these right. difficult things to give us something more. And that was my existence then. So when I think of Joni Mitchell and the oddity that I was never a part of any particular group. I struggled with understanding how I fit. Was I really a part of my culture and the people around me? They had did so much harm to me. And yet I had racism put in my face directly, you know, of being hurt by being snubbed and being called names or being spit at or all of these kind of things. But the amazingness of that is that it was difficult for me to choose any particular side. It allowed me to stand at that crossroad and say, this is an issue of human beings. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not in denial about the oppression of certain groups, indigenous people, Black people, and right. what we have endured and has been taken. That consideration and reality needs to be addressed and directly addressed.
Okay.
And how do we give to people that have given and have had taken from them so much? So that no denial about that for me. I've always been an advocate for the underdog, for my people, for indigenous people, for people of color, right. that we share a very similarity. But in the same breath that we talked about going full circle about the victim and the bully and understanding what made the bully, we also, I had to recognize that I was hurt by people that look like me. And I was also hurt by people that didn't look like me.
Yeah.
And it was equally damaging to just me as an individual. And who do I hate more? Right? I mean, how do you pick and choose
yeah.
the scars? I mean, some of the things that's coming in the next book is to talk about that, how professional people that are there, supposed to be there to help you, really damaged me. Physically wow. and mentally. And so, you know, that's the thing you wrestle with. So when I think about Joni Mitchell's song, being that odd person, this was a long way to talk about this, but being that one that didn't quite fit in any particular group, it gave me a longer lens of perspective.
Right.
And that longer lens of perspective let a lot of things come into my life. You know, one of the things that siblings and friends and people at the time when I was going to marry him, he said to me, they were shocked, first of all, that I would marry out of my race, a white guy from Jersey, a Jewish guy, because I was such, you know, I had the nickname of being Angela Davis, a young Angela.
Wow. Wow.
So I was determined and I was, you know, all of that. And yet that other side of me, when they were people were listening to funk and, you know, all of that kind of music, I found jazz. Okay. And, you know, as a teenager, when, you know, like, who does this? Like, what are you listening to? My sisters and me, you are just too weird. You know, you're just weird. And so I always did these little off kind of things. Yeah. And Seth brought into my life music, different kind of music.
Right.
He brought into my life the sense of freedom, the sense of just being, the sense of a side that I didn't know anything about, you know, that just took me away. I was thinking about this last night. A piece of music came over on some reel that was on social media.
Okay.
And I was listening to it. It blew me away. So I looked up the guy and I was listening to this piece, and he does a lot of mixture of classical, probably jazz infused. And I was like, it just literally levitated me to some other place. It's like in my skin, in my soul, in my being. And I think a lot of people, if we're not a monolith, but a lot of them would look at me and say, what is wrong with you? What is this you're listening to? But it just informs something greater. And it doesn't matter that it was created by a white guy sitting there, whatever his cultural heritage is, it spoke to me. And that song spoke to who he and I were.
Right.
And I loved it. I loved it.
It's a good one. Yeah. Are you still in touch with Seth? Are you still in touch with other folks in the book?
No. Well, let me say it like this. I am sort of not. With Seth, we did for years.
Yeah.
You know, even after I remarried, he was always a fixture in my life.
Yeah.
We stayed close for a very long time. When I left Alaska, he always promised that wherever I went, he would move and we would parent our child together.
Okay.
We did. And we did
a daughter together.
Yes, we have a daughter together. Yeah,
right.
And we did that, and we would do holiday, especially Thanksgiving together. We would always play board games, you know, the guys against the girls kind of thing, and right. You know, so we were very close. He was a big presence in my life until he remarried. Yeah. When he finally, after years and years and years, he remarried a woman that was a very jealous woman.
I see.
And slowly dismantled the relationships in his life, but first and foremost, our relationship. And so, you know, what he was influenced by did allow him, he always said this too, is that, you know, he has no backbone. He couldn't stand up for a lot of things. And the expectation that I would be willing to accept what being used again, being abused again for this person in order to keep the relationship, it was simply not going to happen. And so we no longer see each other. And I embraced the person a great deal.
Yeah.
Wanted to. That's just me. I'm a very open, I believe family is always family.
Yeah.
And they were always welcome in my home and that sort of thing. And just slowly destroyed that, you know. Yeah. So yeah. I'm sad to say. And we were best friends.
Yeah.
You know, he said that often. We really were. We're the best of friends. And that makes me sad, but you know, it's just a part of life and what changes, and there will always be a part of him in me forever. And I'm sure whether he talks about it or not, I will always be there somewhere within his.
Well, that's part of that river you were talking about.
It is.
Well, this has been a great conversation, and I want to hear, you know, about your follow up, the sequel, and I'm sure there will be a third installment maybe down the road.
So, maybe. Just hang on to your seat, Mark, because the next one you're going to be like, come on, really?
All right. Well, Libby, how can people find out more about you and order your book? And
sure. Well, they can order, of course, you know the book, Travel North Black Girl. And they can get it on all of the, you know, mainstream Amazon, Barnes and Noble. They can order it online, any of those platforms. I always encourage people if they will support their local bookstores. So here they can get it at many of the bookstores, smaller bookstores here in Kansas as well as Kansas City. But if you're not here in Kansas City, go to your local bookstore, ask them to get the book and carry it, and be in touch. You know, they can find me at you know, OliviaHillWrites.com, and that's my website. And they can see all of my work there. Excellent. You know, plays and otherwise, and then send me a line, you know, send me a line about what they think, you know, give me a review, good or bad. I'm open for that.
Oh no, five stars all the way.
and talk to me about it. And I'm, you know, and also leave their email address, because, you know, I'll be doing some webinars. I'm going to be working with a professor in Alaska that wrote a book about Black Alaskans and going all the way back to whalers, that Black whalers that was never recognized. And we're going to be doing some stuff online for folks, and they can find me there. But please look for me and stay in touch, Mark. This was it was brilliant.
Yeah, same here. I mean, an hour and a half went by so fast. So.
I know, right? That just means that we have more to talk about.
That's right. You know? That's right.